The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Drone has become a loaded word and code for a controversial tactic in America's military strategy, but that is just one aspect of what the technology offers. From high-end wedding videography to shopping delivery system to aerial firefighting tactic, the future is airborne and the possibilities are endless. Karen Brouillard is editor of Washington Post's Animalia blog, and she reported on a proposal to use drone strikes to save endangered ferrets. Karen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Drones, ferrets, what's the connection here?
Well, just a little background. Black-footed ferrets, which live in the prairie lands of the central United States, are endangered. They're native to the United States, but they're very rare. And one of the reasons for this is that they are totally dependent on prairie dogs. And that's because they both eat prairie dogs, they're carnivores, and they live in prairie dogs' old abandoned burrows. And prairie dogs, as Americans pushed west and developed the heartland of the U.S. and also carried out a lot of prairie dog eradication programs, the population has dwindled. And so the ferrets have found themselves without much to prey on. It got to the point where there were something like only 18 of these ferrets left in the country. Wildlife biologists scooped them up, started a captive breeding program, and they've since been reintroduced to a couple dozen places in the U.S. and Canada and Mexico. So now U.S. Fish and Wildlife is really focused on keeping their population growing and keeping them healthy, and that means they need to keep prairie dogs growing and healthy too. And so one of the problems is that prairie dogs often get the plague, and this is the plague that everybody knows about that's carried by fleas. And so plague is, as it kills prairie dogs, that means the ferrets then don't have enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do is figure out the best way to deliver plague vaccine to prairie dogs. And one of the ways they've proposed to do this is by flying a drone and shooting pellets that are flavored with peanut butter and laced with plague vaccine down on prairie dog places where prairie dogs live, and hoping they'll eat it.
So the prairie dogs will eat it, and they will be eaten by the ferrets. What makes these ferrets an animal that the federal government is willing to go to this great lengths for?
Well, they're an endangered species. And, you know, once animals like that are protected, the federal government has to come up with a management plan and a plan to, you know, bring its population up and hopefully eventually get it off the list of endangered species and to a point where it can sustain itself.
You make the point they're also really cute.
They're very cute. They're very little. They have black feet, just like their name implies, and they've got little black masks.
So peanut butter pellet vaccine delivery by drones. Why not planes or ground vehicles or any other means?
They're also proposing to do this using ATVs. What they've been doing before to deal with this problem is spraying flea powder down into prairie dog burrows by hand, and that's extremely labor intensive. It requires people literally walking across the plains and using a wand to spray down into every single burrow. So they're proposing a couple more efficient methods, one of which would be attaching some sort of dispenser that will shoot the pellets out at a rate of every 30 feet or so, which they've found in tests gets a lot of, you know, something upwards of 3 out of 4 prairie dogs to eat the pellets. One of the ways they're thinking they'll do it is attaching some sort of dispenser to an ATV that would be driven by a person across the terrain. But drones would be even more efficient, probably cheaper than that, because A, it would require not paying any human to do it, and drones could more easily go across some of this sort of rockier and hillier terrain. Planes, on the other hand, because these pellets are very small and they have to be distributed very precisely, they would just have to fly too low. And again, that would just be more expensive. It would require somebody flying it.
Well, you found that there is some precedent for this kind of drop for animal control or well-being. Let's listen to this. This is a clip from the 1950s.
On the shores of Payette Lake are crates full of beavers.
part of a shipment to be dropped by parachute from an airplane. Parachutes are attached to cargo lines, and the boxes are stacked in rows along the waist of the plane. 10 boxes to a load, 20 beaver ready for the flight to mountain...
Beaver dropped by parachute. What was going on here?
Yeah, well, as you said, the dropping peanut butter pellets by drone isn't the first time that airdrops have been used for conservation. This was a program in the 1950s in Idaho by Idaho state officials to redistribute beavers. Beavers apparently were causing problems on private property, you know, cutting down too many trees, I guess, with their big teeth. And so they were scooped up and they wanted to take them out into more remote places where their services and dam building skills might be useful to the terrain and to the rivers. So to do that, they made special little boxes, wooden boxes, I believe they were, and packed the beavers in them but in pairs and flew them out over these forests and dropped them by parachute down to the land. And once they dropped, the box sprang open and they scurried on their way.
Any more recent cases?
Not as wonderful as the beavers, but it is fairly common in lots of states. Texas I can think of, but also several states in the eastern United States do drop bait. Often it's sort of dog food type bait that's laced with rabies vaccine down to vaccinate raccoons and skunks and other animals against rabies.
You write that this is just a proposal at this point to drop the peanut butter vaccine pellets in the Great Plains, but we've heard of these kind of interventions before, and sometimes they're unintended consequences. Did they come up with any of those things that might happen, you know, other animals that might ingest this vaccine and do damage?
Yeah, they have thought about that, and the wildlife biologists I spoke to at Fish and Wildlife said that it doesn't really matter. It won't harm any other animals if they get the vaccine. But one way they're hoping to really target the prairie dogs is that they would drop these sort of in the early morning. I think it's just before dawn, which is when prairie dogs are really active, but the ferrets are not. So the ferrets would not be eating it, and other animals also aren't. So the hope is that prairie dogs would be the main consumers.
Well, maybe a way to upgrade popular opinion of drone warfare, this time on conservation. Can you think, Karin, of any other use of technology for helping out the natural world that we might not know about?
Wow, I think there's a lot, and I think that's a really growing area of wildlife conservation. You know, this isn't a very sophisticated form of technology, but one thing that's just totally proliferating are what's called camera traps. These are remote cameras that are out in the wilderness that are timed to take photos or videos at certain points when animals cross in front of them. And they've been able, by using these, biologists and other wildlife conservationists have been able to learn so much more about how animals act in their habitats, what populations of wild animals there are, what problems they're having. I wrote recently about remote cameras in the Chernobyl zone where people aren't allowed to go, and using those, they've discovered that there's pretty healthy population of wildlife there.
Karin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Karin Brilliard, she writes for The Washington Post and is editor of The Washington Post's Animalia blog. You'll find a link to read her article about potential use of drones to save endangered ferrets. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As one of the fastest-growing demographics in the country, Latinos and Hispanic non-whites are poised to become one of the most important blocs during election 2016. And yet, voter turnout among young Latinos is very low when compared to other U.S. Census groups. That's something John Rudolph wants to change. He's executive producer of Feed Into Worlds, which launched a new app called Unidos. Producer Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with John about what the app aims to do.
John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here, Jimmy.
I got a chance to play around with Unidos. Had fun setting up my profile. Very interactive. Can you talk a little bit about what the app is and some of the tech that you've built into it?
Yeah, so the Unidos mobile app is really all about getting young Latino eligible voters to register, vote, and be informed when they go to cast their ballots. Latinos, generally, their voter turnout rate is lower than the population as a whole, lower than whites and blacks. Young people tend to vote in lower numbers than older people. On the other side of the coin, Latinos are the fastest adopters of smartphones in the country. So we developed Unidos with the thought, let's see if we can reach younger Latinos, first-time voters on their phones where they're already getting their information to see if we can motivate them to register, vote, and be informed voters and break that historic trend of lower than average voter turnout.
So what is it that kind of differentiates Unidos from other Latinx news aggregate websites?
Let's just kind of put this in perspective. Every year, 800,000 Latinos turn 18 in the United States. So that means that since the last presidential election, there are something like 3 to 3.2 million Latino young people who have never voted in a presidential election, may not understand the process. They may not know where to go for information. So we've centralized all of that inside the Unidos app. And so it contains lots of different things. We have a news feed, which is a curated feed where we select stories from a wide variety of news sources. Then we have our guides, which are links to various websites where you can register to vote. Let's say you go to a polling place and you run into some kind of problem. There's an 800 number you can call. There's also information if you are not a voter and you're not qualified to vote, what you can do to get involved in the political process, even if you're not a U.S. citizen. Then we have this really cool gallery of custom emojis. So all of this stuff is shareable on social media. So we're really trying to help young people communicate in the way that they're already communicating, but using it as a way to motivate them to be engaged with the election process.
And I would imagine a big challenge would be keeping in mind the different perspectives and those perspectives thoughtfully informed. So how do you guys go about regulating or balancing coverage and commentary?
Well, I think we do it the same way that any news aggregation site does. And we just look at a wide variety of news sources across the spectrum from different parts of the country. We try to be very thoughtful and judicious about the stories that we put on the news feed.
I think about this, too, is just growing this vote and some of the things that are built in to the Unidos, the app, the registering to vote, this voter's guide, issues with voting, and then linking up to these agencies that can help people through this process. And it got me thinking a little bit more about civic participation and if just the model itself is a bit outdated. You know, we have these horrendous wait times in some communities. We have voter ID laws that are extremely restrictive to certain communities as well, and transportation issues. Is there a day that you can see where people are casting their votes simply off of an app, a different way just to cast votes, to be a participant that makes it easier for all people?
Well, Jimmy, I'm really glad that you asked that question. And I know people say that in interviews all the time, but I seriously am glad you asked it, because this is really what our goal is in Unidos. It's to lay the groundwork and really explore what's going to be the meaning of civic participation in coming years. You know, there's a big debate and there's a big, really a struggle in the U.S. over the idea of voting online. You can't vote online anywhere in the United States, and there are only a few states where you can even register to vote online. But younger people in particular want to be able to do this. They say, we pay our bills online. We take courses online. Why can't we vote online? And I think that there's a real disconnect between the existing voting system and what people expect and what they want to use technology for. Now, there are lots of technological issues to be addressed with online voting, but there are lots of technical issues to be addressed with the existing voting system. So again, Unidos is in some ways an experiment to see how do we use these online tools for civic participation that really results in a satisfying outcome that has integrity to it and that really helps people.
John Rudolph there, he's executive producer of Feed Into Worlds, which tells the stories of today's American immigrants and which created the app Unidos. He was speaking there with producer Jimmy Gutierrez. You can learn more about the app at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Apps are now a great way to motivate people, but music has a much longer history. From Gregorian chants and ancient Hindu ragas to Christian rock, religious music helps to reinforce belief systems and gather the faithful. Just about every major religion has its own musical traditions, but that doesn't mean the music had to be written or performed for the church, synagogue, or temple to have a profound, even spiritual effect. Producer Julie Napolin of Philosophy Talk brings us this story of how a secular jazz musician inspired a devoted religious following.
In the 1960s, saxophonist John Coltrane helped bring jazz to new and revolutionary places.
Many scholars have said that if you listen to a John Coltrane solo, you can hear the cadences of black preaching.
Scott Sala is a professor at UC Berkeley, an author of Freedom Is, Freedom Ain't, Jazz and the Making of the 60s.
In the way that he'll take a small idea, a small bit of melody, and then conjugate it and work out all its variations. And it's a way of finding in a bit of simplicity a world of complication and a world of beautiful elaboration. And you could say it's similar to how people search after God.
Jesus and hey, Lord God Almighty, and you kind of go.
That's Archbishop Franzo King. He's the co-founder of the Church of John Coltrane, a small storefront in San Francisco's Fillmore District. In 1965, King had a conversion experience when hearing Coltrane play live.
I think after the sound baptism, then the music became more than a cultural and historical experience, but it also became a mandate from the Holy Spirit for us to get creatively involved in the establishing of the community and covering the globe with what we call Coltrane consciousness.
King helped start a listening clinic where people would get together and listen to Coltrane records. The group grew into a full-fledged church, and in 1982, it was accepted into the African Orthodox Church of the West. King became an archbishop, and John Coltrane was canonized as a saint.
We say that anointed sound had leaped down from the throne of heaven out of the very mind of God and incarnated in one John, Will.i.am Coltrane. And we beheld his beauty.
Every Sunday, King reads from Scripture and gives sermons quoting John Coltrane.
And then he can reveal to us those things that are hidden.
More than that, he tries to recreate for his congregation the experience of being baptized by sound. The church jazz ensemble features Archbishop King on drums and sax. He didn't start out as an instrumentalist, but learned to play as the church grew.
It began with a love for this music, this African-American classical music, and the revolutionary spirit of the music. And as St. John Coltrane said, the freedom of the music. And it prepared for us the kind of mindset that encouraged free thinking. And it was the kind of music that dispelled doubts and fears.
The music of John Coltrane, man, it's so many words, it's amazing.
For the last 16 years, Irene Kathleen has been coming to the church where she first heard John Coltrane.
I really thank God for John Coltrane and God giving him the blessing, the everything to be who he is. John Coltrane's music is very powerful. It's a music that we really need, that we believe that continues to keep the earth in orbit.
Berkeley professor Scott Saul says Coltrane offers a kind of mantra to carry with you.
It's not so much about a journey to a destination. It's about living within the force field suggested by the music. It asks you to inhabit a kind of space.
For Archbishop King, the Church of John Coltrane is an extension of that space.
It's about uplifting. And it was St. John's desire, as he says in his testimony, to be given the means and the privilege to make others happy through music. So yes, I do feel closer, but even the presence of God in that music and in that sound.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Julie Napolin.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the moment we wake up to the moment we fall asleep, we are interacting with some kind of technology, from the radio or smartphone you use to hear NHPR, to the keyboard I use to type this script, to the zipper you pull to close up your jacket. Understanding how these things work can be as easy as seeing how a wedge works, in the case of the zipper, or as complex as a controller chip that translates your finger touching a smartphone into a request to open an app. And that is why we need our next guest, a man often referred to as America's explainer-in-chief. David McCauley is author and illustrator of several award-winning books, beginning with The Way Things Work, that was published back in 1988. An updated edition called The Way Things Work Now is a visual guide to technology that was pretty much science fiction about 30 years ago, from levers to lasers and windmills to Wi-Fi. And David joins us now from Vermont Public Radio in Norwich, Vermont. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So glad to have you with us. We've been following your books, many of us, for a long time, which you've updated in 1998, again in 2004. Are you surprised at what has changed in the world since the first or even that second edition just 10, 12 years ago?
One of the things that sort of strikes me when I think about the changes and the sort of digital revolution and so on and so forth, when we did The Way Things Work originally back in 1988, it was 400 pages, and it still is, but it was alternate full color, two color, full color, two color, because it just to save printing costs. Now it doesn't matter. You can print the whole thing in two color or four color, and it won't make any difference. So that's a change that directly affected this physical object that I seem to be wedded to.
So it is still 400 pages, which means that some things had to be removed in order to make way for newer technologies. What are some of those things that you had to let go of?
How about the VCR?
What's that?
Yeah, right, the cassette recorder. The best old stuff is still there. My favorite old stuff, the best examples, whether it's a lawn sprinkler or a bicycle or
screws, simple faucet. Rockets?
The screws, rockets, zippers. Rockets have changed, and so the rocket in the newest edition is a new rocket. It's not the – it was the space shuttle, I think, and that's obviously gone. You know, so there are little things here and there. It's been mostly – a process of compression rather than elimination.
Well, VCR goes, but Blu-ray gets added in. Now, this is interesting that despite all the new technology, vinyl is making a comeback. So how do you somehow make room for that? Do you see maybe that someday Blu-ray discs are going to see a renaissance like vinyl is now?
Yeah, I mean, anything is possible, and I still have the drawings, so they can easily be slipped back in if necessary. I think, though, that the thing that makes the decisions work for us is that we're always talking about the basic principles behind things, not necessarily specific pieces of technology. So you'll read the book and you'll see that the Blu-ray as opposed to the CD player. The color of the light has changed, but the concepts are the same. And the book from the very beginning was really all about what are the concepts that seem to underlie basic forms of technology, from the simplest physical machines to the more sophisticated digital contraptions.
Well, I could see line drawings for machines like an old automatic transmission or the basics of a crane. But is there a challenge for you in making these new technologies, often sort of digital technologies and computer keyboards, looking, I don't know, homey, for lack of a better word.
Right. There's been a challenge from the very beginning, because as technology for communicating information has improved, I do think, what am I doing drawing these arrows for when we could animate this? We could, you know, this could be a little bit of video. And I wouldn't have to draw the arrows. I would use arrows only for reinforcement. But there is something fundamentally clear about an arrow. We know how to read them. So whether you're trying to follow an electrical circuit or movement of light hitting a reflective surface and bouncing back, it has a place. And it still works in a very, very basic way. So I guess it does give even the most up-to-date technology a kind of friendly face, because it's still being told using some of these very old devices and means. And I think that's part of the reason why the book continues to succeed.
And we still have our woolly mammoth standing in for us, plodding from page to page.
Absolutely. I have to point out about the woolly mammoth, though, that was not a corporate decision or a focus group. That was desperation on my part. When I was first brought into this and I was trying to figure out, looking ahead at the daunting task of having to deal with 400 pages worth of machines, the question in my mind is, how is this going to be fun for me to do? I mean, I love learning about things, but there's a point. And I thought, in terms of that simple technology, levers and ramps and whatnot, this has probably been around for a while. So I'm going to just draw some cave people looking at a log and a rock, and they'll put the log on the rock and they'll rock it back and forth and they'll play with it. And then they'll realize that, you know, it has these properties. It can be, you can use it as a scale and so on. But what do you weigh? And I had scribbled a mammoth sort of like vision in the back of an illustration, sort of on the outskirts, watching curiously as these little characters played. And before I knew it, the mammoth was on one end of the log. The villagers from the cave were on the other end, and they were sort of balancing and so on. And that started the ball rolling. I fully intended, and I told the publishers this, that once we had finished Simple Machines, the mammoth could go, because it really was going to be forced into the world of flight and pressure. But they convinced me that probably that was not the best idea. And, you know, lo and behold, the mammoth has survived and continues to survive. And I think, you know, in some ways represents the perfect victim of technology.
I'm speaking with David McCauley. He's the illustrator and author behind the, I'm going to say, mammothly popular book, The Way Things Work, which has been updated now to The Way Things Work Now. I think part of the mammoth walking through and representing us is a way to make friendly or make even the most complex concepts approachable by breaking them down into digestible pieces. You know, how a valve opening on a thermostat versus a valve closed will change how it functions. So was there anything that you might have wanted to include, but you just couldn't figure out a way to illustrate it, to simplify it and break it down?
No, I think there are probably things that are more effectively presented because of that approach of breaking down into smaller pieces. But there are other things that are, well, they can only be broken down so far. And yet not to include them in a way looks like a gap, looks like an oversight. For instance, we were working on the you know, additions to the new version, and we'd completely forgotten the hybrid car. Now, the car is a major part of The Way Things Work. It sort of goes all the way through the original edition of The Way Things Work. So I was actually at a soccer game watching my son play and chatting with the father of one of the other players. And he asked me, he said, well, you've got the hybrid car, right? And I went quiet and probably a little ashen. And I said, no, you know what? That, and I immediately, well, game was over. I don't know whether we won. But I, you know, got on the computer and contacted London and said, hey, you know what? We think about this. We've really forgotten something, I think, big here. And so it's in there. Now, having said that, it's still a fairly simple set of drawings for the hybrid. But its presence is critical, and the information is adequate to suggest what the basic differences are.
When you are researching new technologies, the hybrid car. I'm thinking 3D printers or even virtual reality. I'm looking at the virtual reality page now. Do some of these newer inventions just seem mind-blowing to you?
Yeah, some of them are a shock, I suppose, a little bit. But you get so used to them so quickly that those things that were a surprise are so quickly absorbed by me, at least, and become part of the standard. I know what's impossible. What's impossible is trying to really wrap your head around waves and even electricity. And, that's where I am really stuck. There's a three-dimensional aspect to all of this. And yet I'm putting them on flat pages in a good old-fashioned book.
But you do. I'm just looking at the waves pages right now and thinking of this is a technology that's been around for a long time. You talked about other new technologies in the book. How about your own sort of approach from a technological perspective? You know, in the 1980s, when you started working on a book, this book, it was a very different process. You weren't sending out or even faxing, I don't think, at that point, you know, your pages to your publisher. How does it go now?
Everything was mailed. Everything was mailed back and forth, including the final art. The all the original art, the sketches, done on paper, copied and sent by some kind of courier between London and Rhode Island, which is where I was at the time. And, you know, I became really best friends with the FedEx guy. And when we moved to Vermont 10 years ago, that friendship sort of continued, although it was a new FedEx guy. And he was part of the process. And when I gave him this, you know, this package packed with pieces of paper, all of which had original paintings on them, I put a lot of faith in Carl. And he, you know, and they got the job done every time. Now the fact that I just, you know, kind of dial up some FTP site and watch the little duck for 20 minutes, and it's all there. That's something that I'm incredibly grateful for. I was incredibly grateful for Federal Express. I guess I'm just a grateful person.
Do you know Randall Monroe of
Yes.
Yeah, okay. XKCD, he got a lot of attention, or has been getting a lot of attention right now for explaining climate change with a simple chart with stick figures.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of role of you being the explainer in chief.
Yeah.
Do you think other people are catching on to that idea that actually simplifying things or making them a little more human is a great way to communicate them?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I don't think this is nothing I invented. I think that the best communication has always been that way because life becomes more complicated. Whether you start in 1920 or 1820, life is going to get more complicated. The pace is going to change. And therefore, complication is going to become more and more of a burden, I think, in some ways, more overwhelming. I think the need to simplify, to reduce things to basic elements wherever possible, to lay a kind of reliable groundwork for how things work without trying to predict what will actually need this kind of introduction and what ultimately will benefit from it. And then you may need to raise the level of that foundation at some point, or certainly introduce new elements to it as brand new things kind of pop up. But I think simplification and stick figures, it doesn't matter what you choose as long as you are respectful of the information and the audience. And I think more than stick figures, I think a kind of gentle humor that doesn't undercut the credibility of the information is the best thing. For me, it's what I have to offer. And I want readers to have a smile on their face when they go through this book or any book I've created, because it tells me that they're not afraid of the possible complexity of the information we're going to present.
The way things work, the new way things work, the way things work now. Where do you think you're going to be? What's it going to be called in 10 years? Do you think, David McCauley?
The way things work with even more help. The way things work really slowly. I don't know exactly, but I know we will not be short of surprises and possibilities.
Well, Dave McCauley, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
David McCauley is author and illustrator of the award-winning The Way Things Work and its most recent update, The Way Things Work Now. You'll find a link to some of its wonder at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So far this season, the biggest news in football has little to do with the game itself. The San Francisco 49ers' Colin Kaepernick chose to kneel during the national anthem during a preseason game. He said it was a protest against social injustice. Several other players have since followed suit. While vocal critics say he is modeling unpatriotic behavior, one thing is clear. Kaepernick has the U.S. Constitution on his side. In this excerpt from Backstory with the American History Guys, we'll hear about a pair of Supreme Court cases that took on a similar issue, saluting the flag in schools.
In 1935, a pair of siblings named Lillian and William Gobitis were expelled by their Pennsylvania school for refusing to recite the pledge. They were Jehovah's Witnesses, and as such, had been taught that saluting the flag of any government amounted to idolatry. The family sued, arguing that their religious freedom had been violated. The case worked its way up to the Supreme Court, which in 1940 ruled 8-1 against the Gobitis family.
Historian Sarah Beringer Gordon has written about this case, and she points out that the author of the majority opinion, Justice Felix Frankfurter, had been born into a Jewish family in Austria.
What he said was, this is the way you attach a child to the United States. This kind of ritual engaged in with other children in allegiance to a powerful symbol such as the flag was what tied Americans together and made them a nation.
So it was the state's right to promote citizenship among children.
Exactly. And it's fair to say that in the buildup to the Second World War, there was a great sense of danger to the country. And most states enacted mandatory flag salute rituals to do just that.
The ruling set off a wave of violence against Jehovah's Witnesses, who were accused of being unpatriotic in a time that demanded national unity. But a mere 3 years later, the court agreed to hear a case with a set of virtually identical facts. And in West Virginia Board of Education v. Barnett, the court reversed its earlier ruling, siding this time with the Jehovah's Witnesses on freedom of speech grounds. I asked Gordon about this remarkably rapid turnaround.
In Supreme Court time, 3 years is a nanosecond.
Yes.
Very dramatic. It is fair to say that when Frankfurter handed down his opinion, several of his clerks were very distressed by what had happened. And over the next couple of years, justice after justice gave hints that they might like to reconsider the opinion. In part, this was motivated by the violence around the country that embarrassed the United States and its officials. Also, though, the conduct of World War II made an enormous difference. By 1943, it had become clear that something terrible was happening in Germany. Mm-hmm. Nobody quite knew the extent of the Holocaust, but it was clear that Hitler was engaged in widespread violence against minorities, not only Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses. 10,000 were sent to concentration camps in Germany. So this was
because they refused to Heil Hitler.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So partly the court and the country had learned from the violence at home and the violence abroad directed against minorities of all kinds, especially religious minorities.
Did the decision, who wrote that decision, and did it refer explicitly to either what had happened at home or what was going on in Germany?
It was Justice Jackson, who was well known after the war for his important role at the Nuremberg trials. Jackson referred both directly and indirectly, I think, in some of the most quoted and quotable language from the Supreme Court. The eloquence of the opinion is stunning. He said, once we start looking for unanimity in these ways, we achieve only the unanimity of the graveyard. Really powerful, dark language, when we start punishing dissenters for such mild behavior as refusing to salute, we wind up eliminating the dissenters themselves. That's the road he saw. In a footnote as well, he referred to the fact that the salute closely resembled the salute to Hitler. This was a raised arm but palm up salute before placing the hand on the heart, where Heil Hitler was a palms down straight arm.
Is that how people used to salute?
It is.
And what was the reaction to this decision, which in essence was the opposite of Gobitis?
So it's very difficult for the Supreme Court to do such a thing and hold on to its prestige and influence and respect around the country. And the Supreme Court clearly understood this. The decision was announced on Flag Day. So in part, this was about deference to considerations of the flag, as well as the conclusion that we don't need to punish school children whose religion dictates otherwise, that small minority groups who are not themselves violent have the protection of the Constitution when they exercise their religion. And I think the deep desire among Americans to distinguish themselves from Hitler, to say we are not like that, produced widespread satisfaction.
So this was a well-received
decision. It was. The New York Times headline ran, "Blot removed."
And how do we get such a concern for individual rights at the very time that the state is growing, the product of the New Deal itself, and then, of course, World War II and the Cold War that ensues?
Yes.
It strikes me as two different trends.
It's often said that war is the health of the state, and certainly World War II was very healthy for the power and economy of the United States. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court, which had been in the mid-1930s in the business of overturning New Deal economic legislation, had really gotten out of the business of overturning such legislation, and very soon thereafter sent hints through footnotes in economic opinions that it would begin to take the rights of discrete and insular minorities seriously going forward. In other words, protecting constitutional rights against this very powerful new government.
So it's because the state's so powerful that the court said, hey, we've got a new role here.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. It's about what kind of government we want, given how large it's going to be, and what the limits are we want to place on that power. An ongoing battle, one that's never really over.
And that was historian Sarah Berenger-Gordon in an excerpt from Backstory with the American History Guys. And for our last word today, the Dreyfus Affair 2016. At the Emmy Awards last night, Julia Louis-Dreyfus accepted the prize for lead actress in a comedy series for Veep with a moving dedication to her father.
Lastly, I'd like to dedicate this to my father, William Louis-Dreyfus, who passed away on Friday. And I'm so glad that he liked Veep because his opinion was the one that really mattered. Thank you.
Still very much alive, the actor Richard Dreyfuss was bombarded with condolences from people who seemed oblivious to the fact that his name is not William. "I'm actually not Julia Louis-Dreyfus's father," the 68-year-old actor tweeted during the broadcast, "but I really appreciate all the concerned tweets." I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for listening today. We heard music from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Jason Leonard. Word of Mouth is back tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.